Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. We're going to be reviewing some of our favourite pieces of the last while on this week's programme. And so we're going to be hearing from Lorena Natchi about when we become conscious. We'll be talking about rare blood plasma. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at News Talk Science. Now, you've heard on this programme before many times, I'm sure, the phrase, the hard problem of consciousness. And it refers to the fact that consciousness is a very difficult thing to study in neuroscience. It's not something that put off Dr. Lorena Natchi, of course. He's a professor at the School of Psychology and the Global Brain Health Institute at Trinity College. She was one of the keynote speakers at NYU's Infant Consciousness Conference recently to explore its development in the human brain and what neural patterns can tell us about the minds of unborn children. She joins me now. Welcome to the programme, Lorena.
Thank you, Jonathan.
So let's first off talk about what we mean by consciousness before we start talking about this really interesting study.
Yeah, so a very uncontroversial definition of consciousness is the capacity to have an experience, so a subjective experience. So you are traveling, you wake up in a hotel room, you're a bit discombobulated, you feel tired, you might be having a curiosity about everything that's around you, you're excited to go outside. So this capacity that we have as humans to experience the world around us, and from a subjective point of view, so what it might feel like for you might be different what it feels like for me.
That makes it tricky though, right? Because experience doesn't require a physical action. We can experience the world and think internally and be conscious, and yet at the same time we don't necessarily act in the world.
Yes.
How do we study consciousness?
Yes, so that's exactly the crux of the matter. So first of all, we think as scientists that consciousness is enabled by the human brain, and therefore there must be things that the brain does, capacities that it has to enable this experience. And in clinical populations that are in adults that can behave and talk, it's fairly easy to determine clinical conscious status by asking somebody to follow a command or to produce verbal report to say how they feel. But the trickiness starts when people cannot respond to commands. They cannot tell us about their experience, maybe because they had a severe brain injury, or in a very intriguing case, infants, when they are born, they are a very intriguing creatures. Everybody who's held a newborn has wondered what it might be like to be a baby. But because they do not respond meaningfully, they do not speak, it's really hard to study them, to study consciousness in infants. And that's what I've been doing lately and been talking at the NYU Consciousness Study or conference about.
I love that, you know, it's called the hard problem of consciousness, and you've only made it a little bit harder by trying to study the consciousness of infants. So when if we go back, say, before birth, we can certainly say that a baby, we can measure a baby's consciousness in some ways before birth, right?
Yes, I'd say that is sort of the trickiest, the most challenging frontier of consciousness science at the moment. Some amazing advances are being made by studying consciousness when infants are born. So they are already outside of the womb, and we are looking to see whether their brains are capable for the types of conscious experiences that we have as adults. Before they are born is a little bit more difficult. I can tell you more about that, but yeah, just to make that distinction.
Well, I mean, for example, if you poke a baby in the belly, in a mother's belly, it can respond to that. So would necessarily mean there's consciousness?
No. So there is something called a reflex, and that even a severed frog leg will twitch if you prob it with a pipette.
Something you would hope not to find in a pregnant woman's belly.
No, but also just the fact that there is movement in the belly that the fetus will respond to a poke or a stroke on the outside does not necessarily mean that the infant is capable of having an understanding of what might be happening or an experience of feeling good or knowing that there is a mother stroking. So that is a higher capacity that cannot be determined just based on reflex.
Right. Okay.
Behavior.
So if you were to do it like an fMRI of a baby in the womb and you played it music or something, it's impossible to infer the activity that you see in that unborn child's brain as consciousness.
Yes. Yeah, so with infants, with fetuses, so babies in utero, we actually cannot do fMRI at the moment because they are in the womb and it's really hard to distinguish their head from the rest of the womb in a meaningful way with the scanning.
Okay.
But where we're making great progress is when with infants that are born at full term birth, so 37 weeks, that's called full term from 37 week onwards, or before full term, so at 32 weeks, so preterm infants. And when they are born, when infants are born, then we can actually, thanks to technological advances, put them in the scanner, and then we can start to really image how their brain is responding to stimuli, but also whether the brain has what I call the capacity for consciousness. So we have learned from adults that there are brain networks or areas of the brain that are responsive for conscious awareness. So there is a so-called brain infrastructure that has to be alive and firing away for adults to be conscious.
Where is that?
So there are two networks. One is called the frontoparietal network, and that extends from the frontal regions of the brain to the posterior regions of the brain laterally. And there is another network called default mode network, and that is more anteriorly. And what's interesting about these two networks is that the default mode network is primarily involved in thinking about oneself. So when we are at a queue in the shop or we lie down in bed at night, just reminiscing about the day.
24/7 for me. I don't really have to be doing it. Even if I'm actively interviewing you, I'm thinking about me.
That's called mind wandering. And it's completely normal. In fact, most of us spend 2/3 of our awake time mind wandering, even if we try to pretend otherwise. And so that's the default mode network. And the frontoparietal network is engaged in task and goal-oriented thinking. So when we're really paying attention to achieving a goal, like crossing the road in the busy street.
Things we have to do.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
And importantly, though, these two networks are sort of the opposite of one another. When the default mode network is up and going, the frontoparietal network is passive and is suppressed.
Yeah.
And the opposite is the case. That when we're trying to achieve a task, the default mode network is suppressed and the frontoparietal is active. So this ebb and flow of these two networks has been shown in many studies to be crucial to conscious awareness. And that's what we've also been studying in babies.
So, well, I know we're going to get to the study in a second, but given that we have evolved to stay in the womb that much longer, and our response to stimuli, I just assumed that a baby was conscious before it had been born. And it's really interesting to me to think that that actually is not something that we have nailed down yet. But you looked at these preterm infants and just born infants that had just been born. What sort of tests can you do with a baby to see if it's conscious versus giving you some sort of reflex action?
Yes, so exactly what we can look at, because we cannot look at what we call willful behavior or intentional behavior, which is what adults do to tell us that they are conscious. We can put babies in the scanner and we try and see whether this behavior of these two networks that I described, that has been studied extensively in adults, and it is present when we are conscious and abolished when adults lose consciousness. We can try and see whether this is present in newborn infants, whether at full term or preterm babies. But I suppose the background story to this is that there is an ongoing debate when consciousness starts in human development. So there is a number of thinkers and in psychology and philosophy that actually think that children or infants are not conscious by the current definition up to the age of one or two, which seems a bit crazy. But it is a more conservative definition of consciousness, which requires really higher level thoughts, such as decision making or introspection or reading the minds of other people. So really quite complex capacities. And on the other, so this is called the late onset camp. And on the other hand, you have people in the early onset camp that think, no, actually infants are probably conscious at birth or even in the third trimester of gestation in utero. So that's where the work comes in these debates and trying to distinguish which one of these two views is right.
What about attention? Can we not measure attention in newborns and see if they spend more time looking at something new or something old?
No, you can't really measure it because they don't really have control of their limbs. They don't have control of their eyes. So when they're just born, you really
they're just
cannot,
a mess.
They are really like a wet puddle, and people think that they are just helpless blank slates, but in fact, our studies are showing that they are, and that, or at least they have, very complex capacities in their brain than compared to what we might think just by observing a baby.
Okay, so how did you look at their brain activity?
So we there is a very large cohort of infants being scanned at King's College London. At King's College London, about 450 infants, which is the largest in the world.
Wow!
And we leveraged this existing data set of infants who have been put inside the MRI scanner.
Wow!
To look at their brain images and to try and see how well formed are these brains of this wet puddles of newborns, and are they capable to sustain a really complex activity that we know is important for consciousness.
I get it. Putting a newborn baby into an MRI is, I mean, that's getting the ethical approval for that is, it would probably be very interesting, but that's amazing that they managed to do it, because anyone's been in an MRI, it's a scary place to be, putting a brand new baby in there. So they looked at these brain patterns of preterm and newborn in MRIs. That's crazy. And what did you find?
So what we found was that in full-term born infants, contrary to what previous literature had found, in smaller groups of infants and with older technology, where they said that, look, these brain networks are not even developed in newborns, let alone to behave in this complex, dense-like pattern that I have explained. And what we found was that, in fact, the frontal parietal and the default mode network are very distinct in newborns, and they are alternating in this dance of activity and suppression that I have explained is very important for conscious awareness.
Right. So the infrastructure is there.
Infrastructure is there. So what we can say is that they have the capacity. We're not measuring the response to stimuli. We don't necessarily know what they're thinking about, but they're capable of having conscious experiences.
Right.
And the same with preterm babies born from 32 weeks onwards. We found that those babies also have, even though more immature, they have this infrastructure present. So that provides very good evidence to suggest that that infants from 32 weeks onwards have the capacity for conscious awareness. We also looked at this in another study that was just published last month. And here we looked at the same group of infants, and we looked at the way that the brain is wired up. So there is this property of the brain organization called small worldness. And this literally means that the parts of the brain that are closer together are wired in a more dense fashion, and that the parts of the brain that are more distant have sparser connections. And this organization that is kind of a dense local network and a more sparse distributed network is mathematically shown to be the most efficient for information transfer.
Right.
And this, the question was whether this was already developed in infants. And what we found is that even infants born prematurely had this small word property. 70% of preterm babies had this, and babies born at term or born preterm and scanned when they reached 37 weeks, all of them had this feature of small word property.
So you said 70% at 20...
At 32 weeks.
32 weeks, 70%. So that gives us maybe a hunch that it is a later development in the brain, if not all of those babies have developed that some are probably in the process of developing. Would
Absolutely.
That make sense?
Absolutely. All the studies that I have done so far suggest that the third trimester of pregnancy is really important for the development of the capacity for this brain infrastructure to develop. But they also suggest that it's a pre-programmed developmental trajectory. So even if the baby is born preterm, by the time that they reach the full-term mark, as they grow outside of the uterus, they develop this capacity. So that is good news. Obviously, that prematurity is associated with some developmental risks, but the development of consciousness is assured in all of us.
I suppose even without the study, we probably would have known that. But very good. So what is that? How does that inform our moral conversation about consciousness, babies, abortion, and so on?
Yes. Like,
do you think this sort of research helps in any way us come to a moral standpoint on those questions?
It's certainly helping us to go in that direction. So even as late as the 80s, doctors would give would operate on babies without anesthetic, without painkiller, on assumption that babies did not feel any pain, that the babies were simply unconscious. It's unconscionable now to think that, but some of my medical colleagues did this in their medical training in the past.
Oh, so my God.
We have come a long way in thinking that infants at birth have the capacity for consciousness. And then the question now is really, how early does this capacity emerge? And we know that 25 weeks is when the thalamus and the cortical part of the brain are connected. And this is considered a minimal requirement. But as we study infants younger and younger with novel technology, we'll be able to really assess to what extent they are able to have minimal experiences and to what extent we need to really treat these infants and really take care of them in the best way medically possible to enhance and maximize their chances that they develop normally.
When we think of animal models, do we have a good analog for consciousness in animals? I mean, could we understand what sort of frameworks or infrastructure is developing in the minds of preterm mammalian children in the womb? Is that possible?
It's not, because our brains as infants, even in the womb, are very, very different from our mammal analogs.
But so you got to stick a baby in an MRI.
Well, we are developing other methods, including fetal imaging, and I think the technology is going to grow, but we are going towards the first steps to really ascertain that infants, when they are born, especially in the third trimester of gestation, are quite capable of complex cognition, and that we, in this case, they have moral status, they need to be treated with the best care possible, and so on.
It's interesting when you see science and morality kind of intersect like that. Did you take part in this? Because you had a baby recently, right? Did you take part in this study?
Yes. My baby was scanned at 2 months old. So,
oh my God, what was that like? Because, you know, as I say, MRI is a pretty scary machine. Were you like, how did it go? How do they keep the baby still?
Yeah, it's a misconception. The MRI is completely safe from first off from a health standpoint, but of course you will be trepidations with a little infant. But they have this new swaddling blankets now that conform to the baby's body, and they keep them a little bit still. And so what I did is I soothed my baby. I was there, and they got in the MRI, and they didn't cry, and they were there for 20 minutes. So it was incredible.
Unbelievable. Really interesting work. Dr. Noreena Natchi is from Trinity College Dublin. I was speaking at NYU's Infant Consciousness Conference recently. Thanks, Noreena.
Thanks so much, Jonathan. It was a pleasure to speak with you today.
You may have seen an incredible story about the passing of a prolific blood donor by the name of James Harrison. He died at 88 years of age, and he had a rare antibody in his blood that's helped to save, it's thought, more than 2 million babies. To explain how this fascinating story played out, I'm joined by Dr. Andrew Godfrey. He's Medical and Scientific Director of the Irish Blood Transfusion Service. Andrew, thank you very much for joining us on the programme. This is a really interesting story, but I have to start with some really basic stuff, if that's okay, and we'll get there in the end. So let's start off by just explaining what exactly blood is.
Blood is the red liquid that we have inside us that flows around all of our body, and it's with us right from the when we're first in the womb, from about 16 weeks of gestation. And it has a lot of key functions in terms of keeping our body going. It carries the oxygen that we need from the air round to the tissues that need it. It carries the water that we need, the salts and the electrolytes that allow our muscles to work. And importantly, it also carries the white cells, which are an important part of the immune system, all the proteins and antibodies that form the immune system, and the platelets. And those are the cells that help the blood to clot if we get an injury. So it's an absolutely essential part of our body and our makeup. And it actually is one of the organ systems. So when we think about the organs, we talk about the heart or the lungs or the liver, but the blood is its own organ system.
Mm. Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. And when we talk about blood transfusions, we're not really talking about all of that liquid, right? We're only talking about a specific part of it. Why is that?
So when we think about a blood transfusion, it's most common that people receive red cells, because that's the thing that is most commonly low or lacking in the blood. And when we get blood in the transfusion service, we split this up, take off the red cells, and keep them in a in one place because they're better stored in the fridge at 4 degrees. We take off the platelets and keep them separate because they're better stored at room temperature. And the plasma, the liquid that floats that it all floats around in, that's taken off and frozen because that can be kept for a very long time once it's frozen. So we separate them out primarily because if you keep them as a whole, you can only store them for about 2 weeks before the blood's unusable. But if you separate them out, we can keep the red cells for about a month, the platelets for a week, sometimes a bit longer, and the plasma for up to 2 years, actually.
So there are different classifications. Before we go into the plasma and this incredible fella, there are different blood groups using this thing, the ABO system, that people are probably familiar with. Can you explain what the difference is between each of these and why they exist the way they do?
So the ABO blood group is one of many blood grouping systems. We've actually got several hundred different blood groups, but the ABO is the really important one that we absolutely have to match. And it's the one that we talk about when we say we are A pos or O neg. What we're talking about there is the ABO group, the A, and then the RHD group, which is obviously very relevant to this case. So the pos or the neg there is the RHD. But within the ABO system, there's a protein that sits on your red cells, and attached to that is a type of sugar. And it's actually quite important for the immune system that it causes a very strong reaction depending on the type of sugar that sits on this protein. And group A has one type of sugar, group B has another type of sugar, group AB has both, and group A has neither. So when we talk about group O being the universal donor, that's because they don't have any sugars that would cause an immune reaction in somebody if it was given to a group A or a group B person. But if you took group A blood and gave that to somebody who was group B, they'd recognize that sugar as being something that shouldn't be there. And they get quite a vigorous reaction to it. So we treat ABO compatibility as being absolutely essential in the transfusion world. That's probably the one thing that we never relax on.
Right. And so so there's A and B, O and AB, but there are other blood groups that are less common, right? If they were to have a serious accident, would they not be able to find a common donor? Or what are the other blood groups?
So everybody has an ABO group. So everyone will be A, B, AB, or O. And then they will have an additional set of individual specifications and requirements. So one of the others that we often look at is the KEL group, which most people will never have heard of, but is really important for pregnancy, where if you're a woman and you might get pregnant, you don't want to have an antibody to a blood, something within the KEL system. And then there's hundreds of other minor antigens that we sometimes need to match, but for the most part aren't really relevant. So when we talk about the different systems, we think about the ABO group is one system, one group system. The RH or rhesus, which is where the D fits in, is a separate system. So you can have any combination of A, B, O, and then RH. And then you've got all the others, the Duffy, the KEL, the MNS, the JK. So there's dozens more, but they're not normally talked about. They don't tend to cause problems transfusion in the way that the ABO group does.
Right. But the women who availed of Harrison's plasma, which, as you say, is the medium through which the blood cells, the red blood cells and white blood cells, they travel through it. His was very, very interesting because of this potential immune reaction that women may have during pregnancy, because they're carrying a child that has, of course, half of its genes from its father, and that can lead to incompatible blood types. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. That pos and neg is the RHD status of that person. And in Miss Harrison's blood, he had this really strong antibody to RHD. So we call it anti-D. And he got that because he is RHD negative. And he, when he was younger, received a transfusion with RhD positive blood. And this is something we will often do if somebody's got an immediate need for blood, and we give them RhD positive blood because that's what we've got available. That's what's best as a match for them. And so they form these antibodies to RhD. And it's really important when...
An antibody does what exactly? Remind me, because I'm getting a vague memory of COVID and what an antibody is. But what does the antibody do?
So antibodies, exactly. And it's how our body marks something that's in there as not being supposed to be there. So you're right. When we in COVID, we talked a lot about antibodies to COVID, because that means that your immune system is able to fight off the virus because it's able to mark it as not supposed to be there and get rid of it. And so we've all got antibodies in our system to all the things we've been exposed to over our lives. But from a blood point of view, we would only normally have preformed antibodies to A and B, or both if we're group O. We wouldn't normally have an antibody to RhD. And there are two ways you can get that antibody. One is by having a transfusion with RhD positive blood. And the other, which is obviously much more common, is if you are a woman who is RhD negative, so you don't have that antigen in your body, and you have a baby from with a dad who is RhD positive, so baby's RhD positive, a small quantity of the blood cells from the baby leak into mum's circulation. That's normal. That's what happens during pregnancy. And we know that some women would then form an antibody to that, which can affect babies. And so we started using anti-D back in the 1950s. And if we look back then, about one in 2,000 babies actually died of this RhD incompatibility. It's got a very long name. It's called hemolytic disease of the fetus and newborn. But it was really quite a problem. So one in 2,000 babies was the leading cause of a fetal loss at that point. And then we figured out that if you gave RhD negative women anti-D to prevent the formation of their own antibodies, actually that rate plummeted. And if we look at the latest figures, it's now only about one in 80,000 babies. So it's a massive difference.
So they've taken this anti-D, which is essentially telling the antibodies not to recognize this baby's blood as problematic. Is that right?
So yeah. So actually, it's leveraging the immune system to help us. So what we do is we give the anti-D to the pregnant women, which then mops up any of the baby's cells that have entered the circulation before they get a chance to cause a problem for the woman's immune system. So we're leveraging that same mechanism to help get rid of those cells, but before they cause any problems.
Right. Well, when parents go into see a doctor after they realize that the mum is pregnant and they're expecting, is this like the first thing they do is they check and see whether or not this is a possibility that you may have rhesus disease?
Absolutely. It's one of the first tests that we do when you book in when you're pregnant. We check the blood group and we look for anything in the blood that might help. We call it an antibody screen. And it will be part of that initial blood tests that mum has done when she comes in for her baby, is to check and see, you know, are we at risk of this? And if there's any antibodies there, that's one thing. But equally, at the same time, we're checking to see if mum is RhD negative, because if she is, then she'll need to get anti-D during that pregnancy.
Right. Okay. So this fella, Harrison, how on earth did he help 2 million babies? Like, there's a case of a woman in the United States, a young black woman who had a certain type of cancer that meant her cells proliferated very violently. Her name was Henrietta Lacks. Her story is amazing. There's a book called The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. It's an absolutely incredible story. And she didn't know that these cells were very special, but they were actually harvested and used as a medical test cell, and have been and still are used today. HeLa cells are now used in medicine all over the world, and they all came from this one woman. When it comes to Harrison, How have we managed to get so much Auntie D that he's able to help so many babies? Is it a similar sort of situation, or was he just continuously giving donated plasma his entire life?
So he a very, very different situation. So the HeLa cells came from an initial set of biopsies that then have been grown in the lab. But Harrison actually came in every few weeks to donate plasma. Because he knew how important that antibody was. And I think that's one of the things that makes this story so phenomenal is his commitment. And it was all driven by he had his transfusion when he was young that saved his life. And so he wanted to give something back. And when it was recognized that his plasma was able to help so many babies, he just kept coming back every few weeks for his entire life. And what was really special about him was that antibody in him was a very, very high level, much higher than we would normally see. So it meant that because it was so high, that level of antibody, when we harvested the plasma and we make this into what we call a pooled medicinal product or a PDMP, there would be the other donors that would have donated at the same time. But they then go on to treat thousands or tens of thousands of women because it's so potent. It's two million is probably a really accurate estimate. It's an amazing story for him.
So are there other people? Because it doesn't sound like that unusual that he got a blood transfusion of this blood when he was younger. Surely that must have happened to at least hundreds of people in Ireland, right? I mean, are there lots of Harrisons out there that are that potentially could do the same thing, or at least could help mothers and babies? Or is there medical solutions to this that we've come up to, that we don't need plasma donations in the same way now?
Quite the opposite, I think. So we think probably about 1 in 100,000 people in Ireland have an Anti-D. So not that many. We think also that, unfortunately, most of the people that have formed an Anti-D are excluded from donating blood or plasma, either partly because of the process where that's happened, or because now they're outside of the criteria that we would normally choose. There are probably more people out there because most people don't get checked for these antibodies on a regular basis.
Really interesting speaking with you, Dr. Andrew Godfrey, Medical and Scientific Director of the Irish Blood Transfusion Service. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Jonathan.
That's it from us on the programme. Thanks so much to our producer, Marais O'Sullivan, Rory Galvin, Hugo da Silva. And thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. Have a great Sunday.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.